Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Winds of Change here at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. We are heard on the internet at cfuv.uvic.ca. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. And my name is Janine Bancroft. This is the Winds of Change, and we are broadcasting live from the unceded Coast Salish territories, Lekwungen, at the also known as the University of Victoria today. And it is National Aboriginal Day. I believe that's a global holiday, which is pretty cool. I had an update this morning from a friend in Yellowknife who said it's actually a stat holiday up north, so that's pretty cool. And I just want to let folks know that there, if you haven't heard, there's this massive summit going on in Rio de Janeiro. There's the G20 is happening, and then there's also this thing happening in Rio where basically a lot of global capitalist leaders are getting together to figure out how to commodify the environment and make it look like it's a green thing that we're doing and continuing with business as usual. Over 100 indigenous representatives got together over the weekend and prepared something they're calling the Kari Oka Declaration, and that's being delivered today in a sacred ceremony to the summit so-called leaders. So that's something to follow if you can find it. I bet you APTN is going to be covering it, the Aboriginal People's Television Network, which we're blessed with here in Canada. So in the next hour, I'm going to be speaking in the second half with Ted Smith, and folks know Ted is the founder of the Cannabis Buyers Club of Canada. He's been in and out of the courthouse over the years, and most recently had a big victory, actually, what he's calling a constitutional victory. And he's also published a textbook, or is in the process of, Hempology 101 textbook. So we'll have a chat with Ted in the second half. In the first half, I have Mickey Z from New York City, or as he's known north of the border here, Mickey Zed. And Mickey is a vegan and an activist and an author of 11 books, most recently The Darker Shade of Green. And I think that he's really become one of the central voices of the Occupy Wall Street movement. He's written a number, it seems like every other day he's publishing something from and about the Occupy Wall Street movement, which certainly has not gone away. Despite what you haven't heard about it. And most recently, he wrote one called Occupy Hearts and Minds Everywhere. And the one I like, Trade Your Job for an Occupation. They're still saying, get a job, Mickey. Can you believe it?
Yeah. They don't realize occupying is a job.
It is a big job. And are you getting paid for that, for all your writing? Or how do you support yourself?
No, I work in the fitness field. I live in the borough of Queens, which is one of the five boroughs that make up New York City, and my particular neighborhood is called Astoria. It's very most ethnically diverse neighborhood in the world, quite possibly.
Cool.
So I have a great clientele of working class people, and I help them get in shape. I teach boxing and kickboxing, and all the other stuff that I do is are labors of love. That's my mission. I feel driven to do it.
Well, and you've certainly become, like I say, one of the big voices coming out of the Occupy Wall Street. How far do you have to travel to get to where the central kind of organizing happens?
Well, when you talk about Zuccotti Park, where the first encampment was, it's a subway ride from where I am to there, so it's a little under an hour. And then the rest of the events pretty much vary all over the place. You know, the island of Manhattan is where most of the stuff takes place, but it's been really, there are people out on Long Island and so on. So I try to, just in fact, this past weekend I went to Staten Island for what they call Occupy Town Square, which are periodic events which are sort of like just little get-togethers where we invite people in who haven't been involved in the Occupy movement to sort of meet people, find out what's going on, see where they can connect. And it's not so much of a protest or a rally, but closer to like a, what we would call in New York a block party.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of sort of teach-in style events happening. I was noticing the People's Peace Summit that happened yesterday, and that was sort of organizing around this big conference that's happening in Rio. Did you get to that one?
No, I couldn't make it yesterday, but it's going on for a couple of days, so I'm hoping that possibly I can do so. Tonight I'm actually doing a reading here in Astoria, so I'm going to be doing that. And tomorrow night is a major event in Washington Square Park, which is down in Greenwich Village. Related, it's called Night of the Living Debt, and it's connecting student debt, the protests in Quebec, and it's pretty typical of what Occupy Wall Street represents, because it's dealing with a really important issue, but by using a playful title like The Night of the Living Debt and some people actually dressing up like zombies and doing the banging on the pots and pans, it's a combination of outreach, protest, and street theater, and it really stops people as they're walking past, coming over to find out what's going on. It creates opportunities to interact with those who might not be familiar with what these issues are. And for someone like myself who likes to write about the movement and take photos, it's a great chance for me to share this information in an accessible way. So that's going on tomorrow night.
Right on. Yeah, I love some of the creativity that's coming out of this this great revolution that we're having. And so I noticed that you're posting photos with the Red Square. So people are pretty aware of what's happening in Quebec, are they?
Oh, absolutely. Student debt has caught on quicker than I would have imagined as a galvanizing force within the movement here. A lot of the people involved would fall into the age that we would consider to be typically student and are in a situation where debt is a relevant issue to them. And we find that when you do events, like there was something in Times Square a couple of weeks ago, part of what they call Occupy Wall Street Summer Disobedience School, and some of the people dressed up in graduation gowns and they reimagined Broadway songs, because it's right where the Broadway plays are, with lyrics relating to debt and you know, corporate domination of academia and so on. And as I said, it really stops people in their tracks. They come over, they want to find out what's going on, and there's always people handing out information and talking. So the student debt issue actually has become sort of to the forefront currently right now. And my attitude is like, there are so many issues. There's so much to talk about. If there's something that draws people in, then let's use that, and then we could bring it to the bigger picture, which is always, you know, my ultimate goal is to get people to recognize the connections globally as to what we need to do holistically to create change right now.
Yeah, it's all connected for sure. And in your article about occupying hearts and minds everywhere, you wrote about this idea of global solidarity and you did an action at what was it, Point Lookout?
Yeah. That went back a couple of months, and I was using it as kind of an excellent way, an excellent example of what we could be doing more of, where the word came out that the manufacturers of the tear gas that was being used on Egyptian protesters were funded by this particular company right here in Manhattan. And one of the occupiers, John Penley, got together and said, let's show up in solidarity alongside the Egyptians who are going to be protesting in front of Point Lookout Capitol as a way of saying, yeah, we get it. It's not just about us, because it's a very easy way of marginalizing the movement, of thinking that it's sort of self-absorbed or almost just focused on either New York or just certain age groups. But what I found in the movement is that people get the connections. And if we reach out and say to them, hey, this is a great place where we should be today. We should be standing alongside these Egyptian protesters to let them know that we understand the role that American capital is playing in what's going on in their country and who's making these weapons. And in that article, I was saying this, my opinion is that we should be doing more of that, where we should be showing up at events in solidarity with activists on the ground in all communities, not trying to, you know, steal the show, which sometimes happens because, you know, as I said, occupiers, there's a lot of street theater, there's drummings, there's a lot of excitement when the occupiers show up, but there's times where we just need to be there in solidarity, as we did this past Sunday at a big march in Manhattan related to the stop and frisk tactic of the New York Police Department.
Yeah, that's something to talk about. I have a friend who left New York back in the 60s after trying to fight against the Vietnam War, and she said, oh, well, the New York Police Department, they're all a friendly bunch. They're, you know, they're going to be on side with all of this. And I said, well, I think things have changed a little bit. And you call it the blue block, right?
Yeah, well, because, I mean, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, that there's a fair amount of controversy about the quote-unquote black bloc and Chris Hedges in particular. And without even getting into a discussion of what the black bloc is or isn't, or what they do or don't do, and whether you agree or don't agree, there is an armed gang that is the number one source of violence related to Occupy Wall Street right here in New York City, and that is the New York Police Department. Mayor Michael Bloomberg literally calls them his private army. So that's something that we often mention in protests and so on, that these are soldiers in Bloomberg's private army. And there's a tactic here in New York City where people of color, particularly young men of color, are often stopped and frisked without cause. And the New York Civil Liberties Union recently released numbers that were astonishing, that how many there are and how clearly racist these choices are. So there was a silent march put together on Sunday, silent march in the tradition of the old civil rights movement. And it was a broad coalition of activists. And so a lot of us went up there, and there was a pretty decent-sized contingent of Occupy Wall Street in two groups. And I walked from the front to the back of the parade taking pictures and interacting. And I'm proud to say that when I interacted with veteran activists from Harlem, people of color, and they would ask me, well, what brought you up here? I just decided to identify myself as saying, well, I'm here with Occupy Wall Street. And I was happy, really, really gratified that offered a fair amount of almost instant credibility. They were like, wow, great. It's great what you guys are doing, and, you know, it's great to see you up here. And they were offering advice, people that have been persecuted by the police a lot longer than anyone in Occupy has. And that's what I mean. It's like learning from people in communities where being harassed by the police is nothing new. For many people in the Occupy movement, it's brand new. Mm-hmm. People got activated in last September. I've made so many friends in the movement that literally were radicalized on September 17, 2011. Prior to that, they didn't even really have a political life or an activist life. So a lot of this stuff is new, and so their perception of the police might have been, at the very least, indifference. And now suddenly they're seeing how Bloomberg's army acts in such situations. And then when we interact with people of color who their daily life is like this, we can learn a lot from them. So that's been a big part of my writing recently, is to kind of, we're at this point where maybe we should be standing in solidarity with people who've been doing this a lot longer, learn from them, and let them know that, you know, we get it. We get all the connections, and we're here to support you. And the more people in the movement, the better chance we have of creating change.
Right on. And so for people who don't know what September 17th was about, do you want to talk about that a bit?
Well, that was essentially the starting date of what's become now called Occupy Wall Street. For about a month before, whether it was Adbusters or the group Anonymous, they were sending out texts and tweets and so on, just basically saying, Occupy Wall Street, September 17th, bring a tent. And it was that vague, and there was something about it that caught on. And the occupation, what became called the occupation, began. They wound up in a park called Zuccotti Park, which was renamed Liberty Square, because that park had a mandate from the city that it must remain open 24 hours and people could stay in there. Other parks in New York City often close 11 p.m., 12 p.m., so people could legally be evicted. So sleeping in the park is virtually impossible. And part of that is part of the ongoing war against the homeless here. So this park was found where there was a loophole where people could sleep there. And September 17th was technically the starting date, and now here we are heading into July. There's lots of talk within the movement of what's going to happen on what's now being called Black Monday, September 17th, 2012, and hopefully we can continue building towards that and bring more people in and create some awareness. As you said, the movement's not going away. It's coming up on a year. It's bringing more people in, and the corporate media could do its best to try to either marginalize it or ignore it. But I could tell you from firsthand experience, every time I go to an action, I see new people, and mm-hmm. that's encouraging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and folks were camped out for quite some time, and it sort of grew, and there was the occupation of the bridge that I think was a major turning point in terms of realizing what the police were going to do. And were you there? Have you witnessed personally some of the actions and the shutting down of Zuccotti Park?
Yeah, I wasn't there overnight when they, because they came in the middle of the night.
Of course, yeah.
I believe it was November 17th. It was almost exactly 2 months. So I wasn't there at that moment. But I've witnessed, you know, even taken pictures of scenes of what the police were doing. But I wasn't there the day that the action that probably brought the most attention to the movement was when some police, New York City police, pepper sprayed women who they have this tactic called kettling, where they have this orange netting, plastic netting, where the police kind of hold it in a long line, and they begin to encircle people. And once they have you in this encircle, that like kind of trapped in this little orange netting, they could either arrest you or just control you in that spot. And the first time they used that was back in October, and there was some women in this kettling circle, pretty much not knowing what's going on. And there's plenty of video showing you that they're just standing there saying, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And they just got randomly pepper sprayed, and that video went viral. And again, I could tell you from personal experience, several people that I interact with on a regular basis said, when I saw that, I got off my couch and came down here. That's when I began to realize what the lines that were being drawn. And so in a way, the police brutality worked against them because it energized people who previously had probably become pretty cynical, myself included to some degree. I mean, when I first saw the bring a tent September 17th, I was like, well, let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, because you see enough of these protests, and typically it's a Saturday afternoon that people march in circles and they go home, and you say, well, what did that accomplish? And what drew me to this the first time I entered Liberty Square was this clear sense that this was something completely different. I had never seen this commitment to not leaving and to modeling this alternative way of living, where when you were in the park, that little one square block was just a different way that it was showing anyone who entered that park that humans can interact in a different way. It's not, you don't just shrug up your arms and say, well, there's nothing you could do about it. This is how it is. And then you got to see that, no, it's not. This is how it is for a wide variety of social, economic, and political reasons. And we can create change quickly. And a source of real enthusiasm for me, and dare I say hope, is like I said, there are people whose lives literally changed upon just walking into that park in the last week of September of last year, seeing what was going on, and they became radicalized, and their vision of the world was completely changed, and their enthusiasm and their energy is infectious. And it's what brings me back. Sometimes I go to Occupy events, I feel like, just so I get a dose of Occupy. Sometimes I just need to go down there and feel all the energy and enthusiasm and creativity, and I could just soak that up and keep going, because, you know, if you've been doing this long enough, you've seen a lot of ebbs and flows. And after the Obama election, I was thinking, wow, the left really, really lost it in America. And I'm happy to say I was wrong, absolutely wrong.
Yeah, that is so cool. And I think that's really the most awesome part to me, is that, you know, it's wonderful to get out in the streets with a bunch of other people and bang pots and pans and walk with placards and shut down streets and stuff. But it's a whole other thing to, you know, and then people say, well, what's the solution? Nobody seems to know what the solution is. And then you go to something like that and you say, no, this is the solution. This is how we do it differently, right? We work cooperatively and we help each other out, and
recognizing that it's a process,
right?
As opposed to that things aren't, you can't, any successful movement is going to be an evolving process, and we don't need to focus so much right what's going to be the end game. Nobody knows the end game in anything, and so that, to me, that's a lot of wasted energy and counterproductive energy, as opposed to saying, what can we be doing right now?
Right.
And I say this over and over. I, because of this movement, I've been invited to do far more talks, and I'm very thankful for that. And one of the things that, when I'm speaking to people in audiences that maybe have only like a superficial knowledge of the movement, or they're lefties who are very skeptical of it, let's see what this is all about. I say this isn't about purity. This is about process, and I challenge them to risk imperfection. Like to struggle for change is to risk imperfection. Just take a chance. Bring your gifts to the movement. If there's things you don't like, of course there's patriarchy in the movement. movement. Of course there's racism in the movement. These things aren't going to disappear overnight, but they can be dealt with if people are willing to step up and deal with them. And we're creating better and better each day. We're creating a climate where you can deal with it more than you could in mainstream society. In fact, mainstream society almost seems alien at times. You spend enough time with the occupiers, and then if I say goodbye and I'm walking towards the subway and I get on the subway and then suddenly I'm surrounded by a sea of strangers and I see someone and I want to smile at them or talk to them and they'll just stare at me like, you know, who are you? It goes back to New York City mode and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm not with Occupy right now. While in that group, even people I don't know, I can instantly engage in conversation and so on. And as I said, it's kind of modeling an alternative vision and an evolving vision. And I think that's what I would like people to know, that it's not, there isn't some specific end game. There might be issues that, of course, we want, you know, specifically student debt and so on. You want change in a certain way. But I think if people can recognize it as joining a process and bringing their gifts to it, I can't see why anyone wouldn't want to just come down and check it out, just to meet people and see what's going on. Because the media, as always, the media is going to give you the corporate line. And so that's no surprise. So the best thing to do is just get down there and meet the occupiers yourself and bring, like I said, bring your gifts down.
Right on. Yeah, I get that feeling when I work at, I volunteer at the Vancouver Folk Festival every year for many years now, and it's like going to this sort of utopian society where people are all working together and pulling their weight, and you know, there's very little hierarchy. There's some leadership and guidance, but it's a whole other reality, and it's always very sad when it ends. So it's really cool to know that Occupy Wall Street is still happening, and I'm sure in many cities, you know, this has inspired people to talk about things they didn't talk about, to relearn and unlearn and think about the way the world is and create some change. So I want to shift gears a little bit, Mickey, and I know that you're a very famous vegan and that it's a very hot day in New York City, and you posted something about the carriage horses. Now, I understood that I thought that they were getting the carriage horses off of the streets in New York City.
Well, unfortunately, back to Mayor Bloomberg, he has become quite the despot here in New York City. He got elected after Rudy Giuliani was mayor, and Giuliani was one who really helped militarize the police and change New York culture in a lot of negative ways. And Bloomberg came in presenting himself as a liberal, and he did certain, you know, a couple more bike lanes and so on. But when things happen, not the least of which Occupy, and certainly things like the carriage horses, his true colors come out, and he's publicly against any change in that. But there's a strong contingent of vegan and animal rights activists here who, I mean, they're there all the time, and I get perpetually invited to take part in it. I try to stop by when I can. It's near New York City Central Park, near the famous Plaza Hotel is the main point where people get these carriages. And you can go down there, and it's heartbreaking to see the horses, but it's encouraging to see how the outreach being done by these activists. And there's so many people. I mean, there was a couple of really large animal rights and vegan events recently in New York, the Veggie Pride Parade and National Animal Rights Day. And it was encouraging to be around, you know, at these events with so many great animal rights activists, and there's so much being done. Something else that Bloomberg is involved in here, there's a large population of Canadian geese in parks in Brooklyn, and he's decided, along with, you know, his minions, that the geese present a health danger, you know, from defecating in the parks and so on, and they're trying to organize to gather up the geese and have them gassed and kill them. And there's a group of activists in New York who are trying the best to be always present where the geese are, because it seems like they don't do it when there's anyone around. So it's kind of almost like occupying, you know, like people are staying in, for example, in Prospect Park in Brooklyn and defending the geese. And so I think this spirit of activism has infused the animal rights and vegan movement in a very positive way, because people are starting to recognize that, you got to get out on the street and make it happen, and you got to interact with other people, and you can work on an issue like a carriage horse issue, and you don't have to agree with everything your fellow activist believes in. And I see a little bit more of that, and again, that's encouraging, and it's been part of my own personal mission is to try and blend the two groups. Like I there's so many passionate animal rights activists and so many passionate occupiers, and I'm always trying to connect them and say, you guys have so much in common. Let's work together so we're that much more powerful. And little by little, it's happening. And again, that's a source of true optimism.
That's really great. I mean, what a wonderful time to be alive in New York City, Mickey, really. That's so cool.
Absolutely. I feel blessed that, I mean, there was, like I said, after the Obama election, I was thinking, well, I guess I'm not going to be alive for the revolution. So now maybe, yeah, I think, who knows? Who knows? There are changes happening that I couldn't have imagined. And you start to learn to just go with it now. Like, it's not about predicting what's going to happen. It's just like, what can you do to help? And that's what it comes down to. And I've always been writing. I've always been doing public speaking. And this is what I can do. And so I've been doing my best to use those skills in new ways. And it's been invigorating for me. And I've met some of the most amazing activists I've ever met in the past 9 months, and I envision that that's not going to change. I'm going to just keep meeting them, and anything that I can bring from my experience to them is great. And like I said, what I get from them is this incredible passion and energy and a perception of the world that I can't have being, say, X amount of years older than them. So when it comes to Occupy, for example, check your ageism at the door. I've met people as young as 16 that it's like talking to Emma Goldman. You know, it's amazing. So I'm hoping that type of energy can spread far and wide. And you see from the global protests in Mexico and Quebec and Russia and Cairo and so on that they're doing it on a scale that far more than we are. And it's you know, this is catching on globally. And I think that this is, as you said, it's an amazing time to be alive.
And it's really inspiring, I think, too, that it's young folk. I've sort of not so quite so worried about what might happen when I'm like 80. You know, hopefully these kids are going to remember that I was here for them at this time, right? So this afternoon, you're going to something called Boundless Tales. And where can people read, you know, find out where you are and read your writings and see your photos and stuff like that?
Well, I have a website, which Mickey Z or Mickey Z. .net, and I try to keep that, it's a blog, I try to keep it as updated as possible, but I also have a page on this obscure website called Facebook. I don't know if you've heard of it, but
I wonder who might have inspired you to get set up on Facebook, Mickey.
Yeah, I don't know, I just heard that it's kind of a popular spot where lots of people hang out, so they wouldn't let me use just the name Mickey Z, so it's Mickey Z-Vegan, which in the long run actually worked out because it was a great opportunity to meet vegans across the globe. And I post really regularly there, as you know, and all my new articles and photos and information about events and so on. And tonight I'm speaking actually right here in my neighborhood of Astoria at a place.
Uh-oh. Well, he's hopefully speaking somewhere. He didn't just get assassinated or something. That was Mickey Z or Mickey Z from the traditional land of Manhattan in New York City. Well, hopefully you're all right, Mickey. And you're listening to The Winds of Change here at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. So Mickey Z, MickeyZ.net. Now, let's see. It's going to be connecting with Ted shortly, Ted Smith from the Cannabis Buyers Club of Canada. I want to announce that there are a couple of events tonight. If folks are interested in keeping apprised of what's going on in Palestine, there's a really great film that I've actually already seen, but it's worth seeing again. It's called Lemon Tree, and it's about a Palestinian family that is right on the edge of, well, pretty much everything is the edge these days, I think, in Palestine, where they're building a wall, and on the other side of the wall lives an Israeli diplomat who's rarely home. So it's his wife on the one side of the wall, and then this woman who's attempting to maintain her lemon harvest, her lemon grove, as the wall goes up around her, and just the politics and the interaction. It's a very sort of
I don't know if I say feminist, but from a woman's perspective on, you know, what is this really going on here? And what are we accomplishing? And then the other thing, so that's at the BCGU building on Douglas Street at 7. The other thing that's happening is a gentleman who has been on a pilgrimage to Palestine. I believe he's involved with a church group, and they went to Palestine to do some human rights work. And he's going to be at the David Strong building tonight at 7 p.m. here at the University of Victoria, room C126. And I'm going to check the weather. It's we're moving into rain and clouds and stuff again. It's not over 90 degrees like it is in New York City. It's we're heading. It's 21 degrees. It says it's quite muggy out there, and sort of 16, 15 over the weekend. Which isn't the best weather for Fern Fest, but I'm sure people will have a good time anyways in Fernwood Square Friday night and Saturday. Fern Fest is happening. Okay, and I'm going to play a little bit of music and say happy birthday to Art Farquharson. And I'm going to play a song that he sings on his CD, Louder Than the Guns, and it's called Ain't Done Nothing If You Ain't Been Called Red. You're listening to CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. This is the Winds of Change, and we'll be back just in a couple of minutes.
When I was just a little kid, I used to love parades with banners, bands, and red balloons, and maybe lemonade. When I got home one May Day, my neighbor's father said, "Those marchers is all commies. Tell me, kid, are you a red?" Well, I didn't know just what he meant. My hair back then was brown. Our house was plain red brick, like most others in the town. So I went and asked my mama why the neighbor called me red. My mammy took me on her knee, and this is what she said. "Well, you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you've marched or agitated, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead. 'Cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red." When I was growing up, I had my troubles, I suppose, when someone took exception to my face or to my clothes, or tried to cheat me on a job or hit me on the head. When I organized a fight back, why, those stinkers called me red. Well, you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you've marched or agitated, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead. 'Cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red. When I was living on my own, an apartment that I had had a lousy, rotten landlord. Let me tell you, he was bad. Well, when he tried to throw me out, I rubbed my hands and said, "You haven't seen a struggle if you haven't fought a red. No, you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you've marched or agitated, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead. 'Cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red." Well, I keep on agitating, 'cause what else can you do? Are you gonna let those sons of bitches walk all over you? My friends say you'll get fired hanging with that commie mob. I should be so lucky, buddy, I ain't got a job. Well, you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you've marched or agitated, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead. 'Cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red. Well, I've been agitating now for 50 years or more, for jobs and for equality and always against war. I keep on agitating as far as I can see, 'cause if that's what being red is, why, that's good enough for me. Well, you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you've marched or agitated, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead. 'Cause you ain't been doing nothing if you you ain't been called a red, no, you ain't done nothing. If you ain't been called a red, if you've marched or agitated, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead. 'Cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red. No, you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red.
As part of the Ska Fest celebrations, the Victoria Ska Society presents free concerts and workshops from July 11th to 14th featuring Dope Soda, Easy Big Fella, Blitz the Ambassador, and more. Also, check out the Rocksteady Collective Multimedia Art Exhibition on 724 View Street from July 7th to the 14th. It'll feature over 15 West Coast artists, as well as music from Forecast, Whitey, and more. Log on to victoriascafest.ca for more information.
Right, so this is CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, and I have Ted Smith on the line. Are you there, Ted?
I hope so.
Well, it sounds like you are. And Ted, you're going to be releasing a textbook. This is so cool. How long have you been working on that?
I've been working on this for 17 years now.
Wow.
It's like an odyssey journey. I can kind of see the shore now.
That's so cool. And
it is.
And what's the where is it in the production cycle?
Well, right now it's getting printed in Winnipeg and should be getting shipped out here hopefully as early as next week.
And are they printing? Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it won't be available in stores until the 17th of July.
Okay. And are they printing it on hemp by any chance?
Oh, I wish so much they were. When I actually got started in this, it was because of paper, because I was writing books already when I finished university, and then I came out here and I saw the forest and the lack of forest in Clackwood Sound. You know, like they scrape the mountains clear, and that was when I learned about the sort of reefer madness conspiracy and that hemp was made illegal, more than marijuana really. And my family, I'm seventh generation farmer on both sides, and my family should be growing hemp that my books are printed on. But there is nowhere in the world that I could get the paper to print my books on made out of hemp right now. There just aren't the production facilities for that.
Wow.
So unfortunately, I've got to print my book on trees, and then I really want to use this opportunity to push for a hemp paper factory to be built in Canada. But it will cost about $250 million to do that. It's not a cheap process to build a pulp and paper production factory.
So we need to buy a lot of books then.
I don't imagine doing it. No, I need to convince investors and people that are in business that this is a good and smart opportunity. And we need a mill in Saskatchewan or Manitoba to be built, or Ontario, because there's enough hemp being grown there as well. But it's big bucks and big money, and I'm not a businessman. I'm an activist, so I want to inspire people in business to get into it more than actually like build a pulp factory myself.
I think there's a great business case for it, and I've had conversations with Bill over at Hemp and Company there, and he's told me about now this is a while ago, but he told me there's some effort to build manufacturing industry in somewhere in the prairies, so that is that moving along at all, or and stuff? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, things are definitely moving, but we've gone a different direction in our hemp industry here in Canada than the rest of the world. You know, the rest of the world's traditionally been doing mostly fiber production, a little bit of seed production. Here in Canada, we started out trying to do that, but we didn't have the production facilities. And in the early years, after 1998, there's a lot of hemp that was grown, and unfortunately, it just got composted because there was nowhere to process it. So Canadian farmers switched over to seed, and now we're the largest seed producers in the world. We make a lot of food out of it. We ship a lot of it to the United States, a lot of cosmetics as well, like soaps and stuff. But the fiber is still mostly being used for compost. And so I've actually made a great connection with Blake Hunter from Good Seed Hemp. And he's got a family farm in Saskatchewan. And again, you know, they grow hemp every year for seed, but then they just end up composting the fiber. And he actually wants to get into hempcrete. That's the direction he wants to go, in part because, again, the production facilities for paper or even, you know, for rope are fairly high. And so on the other hand, though, there's lots of other people looking at, say, hemp insulation. There's a company at 100 Mile House that's really pushing for hempcrete as well.
Sorry, what's hempcrete?
Well, hempcrete is when you take the herds, and the herds are kind of like the cork in the center of the plant, like the fiber, like the hemp plant grows, you know, 15 feet tall, and the fibers on the outside of the stalk, and in the middle of it is something called herds. It's sort of like a cork. And so when you separate the two, it's actually the herds that you want to make building materials out of, not really the fiber, ironically, because the herbs actually, or the herds calcify if you add lime and water, and it literally, you know, turns into a rock-like material, and it makes excellent concrete. And so there's experiments, you know, or not, I shouldn't say experiments, there's homes being built all over the world right now with this. There's actually a home on Salt Spring built out of hemp.
Cool. So yeah, lots of stuff. And but your kind of focus is cannabis, right?
Well, I cover the whole plant.
Okay.
And for me, my textbook in getting back into hemp is kind of getting into my roots, because that's where I started. But what happened to me was I got sort of sidetracked with medical marijuana. 17 years ago, I moved to Victoria and started teaching people, and then I began meeting patients. And so I started up the Cannabis Buyers Club, which is now actually the oldest dispensary in the world. And I just lived in a van at the time. I got a pager and a pamphlet and started helping people out. And it's gone from the van to an apartment to a store. I've had for 11 years now. We have approximately like 4,000 patients that come to the club. I probably employ about, you know, 20 growers trying to keep it up with medicine, and got a nice staff of just to keep it all going. We make 30 food and skin products as well, so we provide lots of alternatives to smoking. Really pride ourselves on the quality and price of our food and skin products. And so the Buyers Club has been what's taken the book 17 years. It's not that it took me 17 years to write it, but it is something that the work of the club, you know, literally, you know, at times, you know, keeping people alive and healthy has been more important than writing the book.
Well, and you know, working with the street community, I can appreciate that they have access to a pain relief, right? I mean, it's not easy out on the streets, and I know several people who really depend on this product to so they can function day to day, and you know, and they're harassed and arrested, and their stuff is stolen from them by the police, and I just find that all really, really frustrating. So I really appreciate all that you're doing, Ted, for our community here. I want to talk a little bit about the court victory that you guys had back in April. Do you want to talk about that?
Half years ago, our bakery got raided by the police. My friend Owen Smith, no relation to me, was charged.
Ted, we are having a hard time hearing you. Can you go back to where you were standing before?
Oh, sorry, I was in a cafe. Is it better reception
getting
here?
Getting better, yeah. It's a little noisy in the background, but that's okay.
Okay. Right. My friend Owen was charged with trafficking in THC. And that's because even if you have a medical marijuana license from Health Canada, because they have their MMAR program, you are still not allowed to make extracts. So if you cook it into a butter and squeeze out the leaf, you've actually produced a drug called THC. And so my friend Owen was charged with trafficking in THC. And we argued with expert witness Dr. David Pate that, in fact, these kinds of extracts should be allowed, that if the plant itself is allowed to be grown and used, that there is, in essence, nothing harmful that can be made from it. The plant is very healthy. Certainly when you compare it to other prescription drugs that are out there, even over-the-counter drugs like aspirin, it can kill you, whereas cannabis cannot. And taking out the plant material, whether you're making a cookie or hashish, is actually making a healthier product, because the plant material itself doesn't contain medicine as much as the actual, what they call the trichomes, or sort of the resin glands that form on the surface of the plant. And that's where the THC is. And so, in essence, Health Canada has kind of tried to make the THC, you know, illegal for people to produce themselves. And at the same time, though, synthetic THC is legally available in stores. You can pay $8 for a pill that contains, again, just this one chemical that's in the plant. There's many chemicals that are in each plant that are beneficial, aside from THC. But, ironically, the government thought that they could, you know, provide patent protection to pharmaceutical companies for THC, but then make it illegal for anybody to produce it naturally. So with some patients and Dr. Pate testifying, along with myself, we were able to convince the judge that the laws were unconstitutional, and he struck down the section of the regulations that only allowed for dried marijuana, and made a ruling that would allow for patients to make anything. Wow. Now, the ruling was really interesting, though, because it happened in what's called a voir dire, which is kind of a trial within a trial. It's sort of like a pause to look at a technicality. And so the judge has ruled in this voir dire that the law is unconstitutional, but he also ruled that it was still in the public interest to proceed with a jury trial. And he didn't say why. We can make some assumptions. But nevertheless, next February, we're still going ahead with the jury trial with Owen, with the charges with trafficking THC, even though the law is ruled unconstitutional.
Huh.
Now, another interesting point is that the government cannot appeal this decision right now because the trial hasn't concluded. There's no verdict. They actually have to wait until the conclusion next year before they can appeal. So at this point, we have a judgment that's, you know, declared it, the law is invalid in this particular case and made it legal for patients to produce their own medicines if they want, and the government can't do anything about it.
Well, that's pretty interesting. So that gives you another opportunity to go back to the courtrooms and educate people, I guess, on what's going on. Do they have to find a jury who's never exhaled or something?
They're going to have a tough time finding a jury because it's not so much a jury that hasn't smoked pot, but they have to find a jury in Victoria that's never heard of me or my club.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, I've helped, you know, thousands of people. I know quite a few people in town. We've been in the media a fair amount. They're going to have to really, you know, find basically, you know, a whole bunch of people that just moved here from Alberta or something to sit on the jury.
Right.
But we're quite convinced that, you know, there's no jury in this country that will convict Owen of trafficking and THC for making these products.
For making cookies, yeah. Well, let's hope not. And so is this is a BC court case, or is this Canada-wide then, is it? Or?
Well, it's a funny thing, because it's just happened at the, you know, sort of lower court, although it's called the BC Supreme Court, so it kind of sounds really big, but it's sort of like the lower level. We have to really go to the Court of Appeal to have it provincially binding, because ironically, this decision and even a BC Court of Appeal decision isn't binding on other provinces, though it's very persuasive. And so this decision here technically only covers people in BC. And if Health Canada was going to abide by it, they would change the laws for everybody in Canada. However, it's quite clear that Health Canada is not going to abide by this ruling, and they are going to fight it. And appeal it, but they just have to wait till next year. They can't do it yet. At this point, I would suggest that not only are people in BC protected, but if anybody else in Canada was actually charged with, you know, possession of THC, if they have a medical reason, you know, those
like
those charges should be beaten.
Stress is a medical reason, right? So there's lots of medical reasons. I mean, headaches and stress and inability to sleep and pretty much all kinds of stuff it's good for, right?
It's amazing the list of things that it's good for. There's a lot of different benefits that can be found from cannabis, especially when you look at all the different ways that it can be consumed and made into products. It's a wonderful plant. It has a lot of uses.
Mm-hmm. And to compost the fiber seems a bit ridiculous. So I wish you luck on getting that moving. Now, coming up is Cannabis Day on July 1st. So what do you guys got planned for that?
We hotboxed the front steps of the courthouse on Canada Day.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there's these cement stairs, you know, if you go into the courthouse off Blanchard. And we hang curtains on either side of the stairs, so we can fit about 80 or 90 people underneath the stairs there, and we hotbox it for a couple hours. Actually, usually the hotbox only lasts for about 45 minutes or so. And we'll play my game show there as well, Reach for the Pot. I have the world's only cannabis game show. It's a lot of fun. We'll hotbox it at 4:20 and then play the game show after.
So now, you've done this before?
Yeah, we've done it, I think, the last 3 years now.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, it's really funny. The security came up to us last year and said, hey, you have to leave. You're not allowed to be here. And I told them to call the police right away because it's Crown land. You know, we're allowed to be there.
Right.
But they go and they harass and intimidate people all the time off that property.
Mm-hmm.
The security just come up and they just tell people, you're not allowed to be here.
Huh.
So I challenged the guy, you know, and said, well, you know, what do you mean we're not allowed to be here? Oh, no, sorry, this was at Halloween because we do a Halloween event there too. And so this the last time we were there, it was pretty funny to me. I asked the security guard why we weren't allowed to be there. He told me that at 6 o'clock in the evening, that the ownership changed from the Crown. And I'm like, pray tell, because, you know, no one's ever heard of this before. Who is it that owns the property at night that wants us gone? And he had the nerve to tell me it was the Queen.
Oh. Well, and how does he know that the Queen doesn't want you there?
It was pretty funny. The police corrected him on that matter. But, you know, the security guards at the courthouse just, you know, think they're very high up there, but no, we're allowed to be there, and the police know my group very well, and you know, we're not going to make a mess or cause any damage to the property or anything. So, yeah, the police have got no problem with us being there.
And you were banned from the UVic campus for a while, but you're back here too now, right?
Yeah. I got banned. It was actually back in 2000. I got arrested for sharing some joints up there, and was 2005 that I got back, and now we've really cranked it up a notch, and Hempology is the largest student club at the University of Victoria. We have been for now 5 or 6 years.
That's great.
We have weekly 4:20 meetings during the school year. They're not happening in the summer, but every Wednesday at 4:20 we gather right around the corner from you at the Student Union building, and teach a free lecture series as well. There's 22 free classes. We broadcast it live on the internet as well, and they cover everything from the ancient history of cannabis and hemp to law and politics and things that are happening now. We also hold a convention there once a year, and we're really hoping my textbook will help expand Hempology onto other campuses. Right now we have 4 clubs, one at UBC, VIU in the Nanaimo, and UVic, and we actually have one now at Mount Allison University in New Brunswick. But we really want to get campus clubs happening at universities all around the world, really. So.
All right, well, the textbook's the way to go then. So, Ted, where do people get more information about the club?
Well, hempology.ca is my main webpage, and if you go to the right side of that, you can see links to a whole bunch of things that we do. There's a link to my older version of my textbook. We have forums. We have YouTube videos. You know, I'm on Facebook. All that sort of stuff is on the right-hand side, a link to the Buyers Club. We have our product guide so people can make everything that we make in our kitchen. You know, we explain all the details so people can make their own medicines. I think it's really important that people are able to make their own medicine here and be independent of drug companies if possible.
Right.
for us if they can, you know.
Yeah, that's so great. And I know a lot of people really appreciate the work that you do in our community, Ted. And we're about out of time, but we'll just remind people the Cannabis Day at 4:20 at the courthouse, and check your website, hempology.ca, and maybe you'll come back and let us know what's going on with the trial that's happening for next February.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Ted. Take care.
Bye-bye. Cheers. Take care.
Okay, another interesting Winds of Change hour. I want to thank Mickey Z or Mickey Z, depending on which side of the border you're pronouncing that from, who shared his adventures in Occupy Wall Street, and Ted Smith, the founder of the Cannabis Buyers Club of Canada. And all the people who keep the station alive. I'm going to play us out with some music from Laura Vinson in the spirit of, I think it's a global Aboriginal Day. I don't think it's just national. I think it's a big deal. And I hope that the folks in Rio are going to keep those guys honest and say, look, we are tired of buying and selling our beautiful earth. This beautiful earth, it's not for sale. So take care of each other out there, everybody, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. You're listening to The Winds of Change at CFUV. Of course, stay tuned for Democracy Now! And all good programming here at the station.
Rodney King, 1965-2012. Mention the name Rodney King, and people react. They might react in different ways, but they react, for almost no one is neutral. His name is evocative because it ties you to one of the biggest urban rebellions in America, the 1991 Los Angeles riots, after the acquittal of a phalanx of cops who beat King mercilessly on videotape. When a predominantly white jury in Simi Valley acquitted them, the streets of L.A. exploded. It was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. Not since the 1960s have we seen riots so large or so destructive. The riots made Rodney King famous or infamous, depending on one's perspective. The image of his battered face asking plaintively, "Can we all get along?" have entered the realm of history. A question we have yet to truly answer. Rodney King, age 46, was found dead early Sunday morning, apparently drowned at the bottom of his pool. For Rodney King, his fight is over. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Rising up the boat. Play every jig you know, and we'll dance until it's time to go. She was just a little girl, but she remembers when Grandpa would sing and play the violin. The traders would come with their furs and moonshine, and they'd dance until the sun would shine. Grandpa sang the violin. Set in, and they came across the ice with the horse and the sleigh. She remembers when they took him away. Oh, Grandfather, I hope you hear me now. Listen to the words I write, won't you show me how to sing about that joie de vivre, 'cause all we have is now.
Coming up next is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.